Can everybody hear me okay? You know, those of you that have heard me speak before, I want to start out with a story that maybe you've heard and that a lot of you maybe have not. But I think it's kind of indicative to some degree of life and what we do in cells and what we do as teachers and things like that. But there was this lion that was deciding he had a little bit of a self-concept problem. And so the first thing he did is he sought out a zebra. And he went up to the zebra and he said, "Who's the king of the jungle?" And the zebra said, "Why, you are, Mr. Lion. Everybody knows that." And he goes, "That's right, and don't you forget it." And he felt a little bit better about himself. So he goes on a little bit further and he finds a giraffe. And he goes up to the giraffe and he says, "Who's the king of the jungle?" And he's feeling pretty good. And at first the giraffe didn't hear him. He's way up there in the trees, you know. And so he gets a little bit closer to the giraffe and he says, puffs out his mane a little bit and he says, "I said, who's the king of the jungle?" And the giraffe looks down and he says, "Why, Mr. Lion, you're the king of the jungle. We all know that." And he says, "That's right, and don't you ever forget it." And then he goes up to a lion that's just kind of, he goes up to an elephant that's just kind of eating there and enjoying himself near the water. And he goes up to the elephant and he says, "Who's the king of the jungle?" And he's feeling really good about himself, and the elephant just ignores him. So he gets a little bit closer and he puffs out his chest and his mane. He says, "I said, who's the king of the jungle?" And the elephant just ignores him. So he gets right up next to the elephant and he lets out a mighty roar. And he says, "I said, who's the king of the jungle?" And the elephant reaches over with his great big trunk and he picks up that lion, just flings him up against a tree. And the lion comes down slithering and shakes himself off and he says, "You don't have to get mad just because you don't know the right answer." Well, I want you to know I don't have all the right answers. We have a unique business. There's a lot that's changed in our lives, those of us that have been around a lot, but it's still the greatest business on the face of this earth. I want to start out by mentioning I am not a public speaker. I want you to know that. Don't sell books. I don't sell programs. I don't get paid for speeches. But I love an industry that has changed my life. And today what I'm going to do is talk to you a little bit about my passion and why I have a passion for this business. And I want to start out by talking to you, first of all, about my trek into the insurance business. My father, when he married my mother in 1936, they lived in Salt Lake City, Utah, and my father bought his very first life insurance policy from the company that I now represent, American National Insurance Company, in 1936, from a debit agent that went door to door. Well, fast forward a lot of years. I was a young man. Now we'd relocated to California. I was living in Redondo Beach, California. And an insurance agent who happened to be my scoutmaster, still with the exact same company that I represent to this very day, comes over to our house. And I'll never forget it as he came in and he was wearing a hat. And who wears a hat nowadays? They don't. But back in those days, insurance men wore hats. And I always remembered that. And it was kind of a rainy night. And I remember wondering what it was he was doing. But he sat down and I noticed I had a very intense but yet a nice conversation with my parents. Well, come to find out, he had sold each of them a life insurance policy. And both of my parents were turned down. They both didn't qualify for life insurance. Well, instead of getting mad at the company and get mad at the underwriters and get mad at everything that happened, what he did is he went back in and he said to my parents, he said, "Look, there's some things in your life physically that are not going to allow you to get life insurance anymore. What I'd like for you to do is not let this happen to your son, Kenny. You need to buy some life insurance on him." And my parents did. A policy that is still enforced to this very day, and it's 100% paid up. And so anyway, so fast forward now. I got married. I happened to find the prettiest girl that I could possibly find on the face of this earth, and married her, and I took her on a very unimpressive honeymoon. And that bothered me a lot. So time went on, and I decided I wanted to make that up to her. And so I wanted to take her on kind of a honeymoon after we'd been married a couple of years. And I called my dad. Now, my father was a hardworking man. He was a lumberjack. He was a railroad man. He was a truck driver. He was a warehouseman. His whole life, he felt you needed to work with your hands. And he was a man's man. And so I called my dad up, and he was one of these individuals that felt you should always take care of yourself. And I called my dad up, and I said, "Dad," I said, "I want to take Marcia on a real honeymoon, a vacation." I said, I need $280. Now, why that figure now? I don't remember why that amount, but I just remember the amount. And I said, can I borrow some money from you? And he said, no. That quick. not even a hesitation. He said, but son, I have this life insurance policy on you. I don't know much about these things, but I think you might be able to get some money out of it. So we went on down to the local office of American National Insurance Company. I went in, and I was working for a bank at the time. I was working in the collection department of the bank. And I walked on in, and I said, I'd like to borrow some money. My dad was with me, and he had the policy. And my dad gave me the policy. He said, son, this is yours. And so I said, I'd like to borrow some money. And the young lady came on out, and she had me fill out some paperwork. And I thought it was going to have to be a credit application. It was going to have to go in and then come back. And I said, now, are you going to check my credit? Because I worked for a bank. And she said, oh, no, we're just going to send away for the money. And I said, well, do I get a payment book? And she goes, no. And I said, well, how do I know when to make my payments? She goes, well, you'll just make them whenever you feel like it. And I said, I just make my payments whenever I feel like it? And she said, yes. And I said, well, what if I'm late? She goes, no problem, you make them at your pace. I said, what if I don't pay them? She goes, then we'll just take the loan off the face amount of life insurance if you die. And I said, well, how much is my interest rate? And she said, it's 8%. And I thought, on an unsecured loan? The bank at that time was 14 to 21%. And I said, 8%? She goes, yes. She goes, but we credit you back 4% on the borrowed money. So it's a 4% net loan. And I said, well, I think I could sell this. And the general agent come running out of the room, and it was not Floyd White, by the way. It was his predecessor, Orson Millett. And he come running out of the room, and he goes, you think you could sell this? And I said, yes. And he goes, I have a test I'd like you to take, and if you don't feel like taking it, I'll take it for you. And so, which he must have already known me well, because here I am speaking at Brigham Young University, and a couple years ago I spoke at the University of Utah, and a couple years before that I spoke at UNLV, and not any one of those three colleges would have ever let me in as a student. So maybe he felt he needed to go ahead and do that. So that started my trek into this great business of ours. But I want to say something about association meetings like this. This is one of the most important things you can do, and I'm going to address it later, is to come together like this. This is a quote I got many years ago, and it's always meant a lot to me. It says, it's by Joseph Marshall Wade, who was a clergy in the 1800s. He said, if I wanted to become a tramp, I would seek information and would seek advice from the most successful tramp I could find. If I wanted to become a failure, I would seek advice from people who have never succeeded. If I wanted to succeed in all things, I would look around me for those who are succeeding, and I would do as they have done. When you come to a symposium like this, the Grant Taggart Symposium, you have the opportunity to listen to and to look around the room and to associate with great individuals that are succeeding in this business and in life. I have been a perennial member of the Million Dollar Roundtable, and I've gone to those meetings on four or five occasions. And it's amazing that some of the most successful people up there with some of the highest incomes also are succeeding in every other area of their life, as you saw yesterday, with their families and with their churches and with their organizations and what they believe in. When you come together in an organization like this, I'm going to offer you a challenge that I offer for every single time that I spoke over the last few years for Gamma International. And that is, this room should be double. I'm going to challenge each and every one of you next year to come back and to bring two people, one from your company and one from that's not from your company. And I'll give you an illustration a little bit of why that is important and why we come together as an organization and why we have the strength in numbers that we have. Let me start out. I want to start out by showing you a slide, if I could. Many of you recognize this slide. This is Machu Picchu. Our oldest son had served a mission in Peru, and we went to go pick him up, and we went up to Machu Picchu, which many of you have seen that, I'm sure. But it's one of the most gorgeous sights I've ever seen. You can see the steep cliffs and the ridges, and it's surrounded by an emerald jungle built in the 15th century, but with primitive tools and architecture knowledge and things like that. And yet it stands as one of the most mesmerizing edifices I've ever seen in my life. But you'll notice that it's empty. That it's all the people, basically except tourists, are gone. And yet it was one of the great structures of this world. This is a condor. While we were in Peru, one of the things that we noticed was that in their religious culture, the condor was very, very important. Now, many of us know that the North American condor became pretty well extinct up here in the United States. But let me tell you about the condor. The condor can live up to 60 years. And in some of the architecture on the walls and everything like that in Machu Picchu, the condor was a very important part of their religion. It can live up to 60 years. It has a wingspan of 9 to 10 feet. It soars a dizzying 15,000 feet in the air. The condor is the largest flying bird in the Americas. The California condor went to the brink of extinction in 1987. There was 22 condors left. That was it. And then what had happened was a plan was put into place. All 22 birds were captured. It was the most expensive species conservation plan ever in the history of the United States. But by taking proactive and measures, in 2008, there was 327 condors, with over half of them living in the wilds. The American eagle. All of us know that the American bald eagle in the 1700s became our national symbol. There is over 300 to 500,000 eagles at that time in the United States. The eagle went almost to the brink of extinction. As a matter of fact, at one point in time, there was only 412 American bald eagles left in the 48 contiguous United States. Well, let me tell you about the eagle. The eagle lives up to 25 years in the wilds, 40 years in captivity. It has a wingspan of 8 feet. The eagle can fly 65 miles an hour. And it soars up to 10,000 feet. In a dive, an eagle can go 200 miles an hour. So you can imagine the impact when you watch it hit that water and pull up its food. A magnificent bird. And it went to the point to where it also almost went to extinction. In the United States, at one point in time in the 1950s, it was down to 412 birds that they could count in the contiguous 48 United States. They also started a conservation program, and as of 1992, there was over 100,000 birds, and 2 years ago, you probably saw the announcement that there was bald eagles in every state in the United States with the exception, that were in the wilds with the exception of Hawaii. Well, what was it that happened to Machu Picchu and that great civilization? What happened to the condor and what happened to the eagle? One almost went to extinction because they did not have the ability to adapt to change. In our industry, we have to have the ability. We individually have to have the ability to adapt to change. That's why we come to meetings like this. That's why you go to company meetings. That's why you go to Million Dollar Roundtable. That's why you go to NAFA, is to give you the tools that you need. Once the condor and once the eagle received the tools that it needed to adapt, it was able to make the changes it needed to make a powerful comeback. But here's what happens when we don't get involved in the Society of Financial Service Professionals, in the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, in General Agents and Managers Association. This right here is a perfect example of what happens when we don't get together. During the Civil War, there was a battle of Chattanooga. This is Missionary Ridge. In this particular battle, as in the beginning of the Civil War, the Southern troops actually had more troops than the North. They actually had more ability to win. The majority of the millionaires in the United States at that time lived in the South. The large plantations were in the South. They actually had developed their own economy and actually had an alliance with Great Britain. Well, at this very pivotal battle, which was a very important one, What happened was the Southern generals decided that it was better if the troops were in individual bunkers so that they would not see their comrades fall. So what happened is they put them into the individual bunkers, and as they saw the onslaught of the Union troops, what happened was they could not hear their leaders' encouragement. They could not see their leaders leading out. They started to see what few comrades they had fall, and they couldn't see the massive amounts that were not falling. Then all of a sudden they saw some of their comrades give up and start walking towards the Union troops. And pretty soon the hill was lost. Not because the individuals were cowards. Not because they didn't have the manpower. Not because they didn't have the equipment. But because they felt entirely and totally alone. In our industry, when we have to face the Susie Ormans and the regulators and the anti-insurance people and the anti-investment people, and we hear always of the Bernie Madoffs and all those sorts of things, what happens is we begin to feel alone unless we gather together at events like this. This is one of the most critical things you should do. Every one of you should talk to the people here and shake hands and get to know them. There's individuals in this room, one of them sitting right there, Brian Daybell, that changed my life because of me meeting him here at the Grant Taggart Symposium, and many of my agents. This is what you come here for. Well, let me talk to you now a little bit more about my trek and the insurance industry. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to start a tape. Before this tape starts, I want to tell you, I live in Henderson, Nevada. This was an event that took place where a jet propulsion factory in Henderson, Nevada exploded. Some of you are in this room that would remember that day. And it exploded. And right before you start that, let me just give a little bit of background here. At that time, the freeway did not go out to Henderson, Nevada from Las Vegas. My office was in Las Vegas. One day, I decided to take off at lunch, which I did not always go home at lunch because it was kind of a trek across the desert. And I was heading home, and the freeway came to an end. I got off there, and I was going up a street called Boulder Highway, and I looked out, and I saw this massive smoke cloud over my city. As I looked at it, I could tell that it was the Pepcon jet fuel factory. And I realized that my house was probably about 3 miles away as the crow flies. My daughter, who was in the eighth grade, was probably about a mile and a half away from that factory. I was getting on the phone to try to call my wife before cell phones, and I was on a payphone at the 7-Eleven, and an explosion hit, which you're going to see in just a minute. Knocked food off the shelves. The individual standing next to me actually went down to his knees. I couldn't get through. Every line was busy. I got in the car. I was racing with everything. I was breaking every underwriting law there possibly was for a property and casualty insurance agent. And I'm racing down the Boulder Highway trying to find a way. Already every single exit to get into my housing area in the city was closed off. I finally took some back roads in. I was going through downtown Henderson, and a huge explosion hit, and I saw roofs peel back, and I saw cars lift off the ground. And I realized that my children were near that. And I began to race in to get to my house. And then I saw, as I was going into my housing tract, and I saw homes with roofs gone, windows gone, doors gone, garage doors gone, and I saw my wife coming out with our youngest son. And then I knew what I had to do was to make it to my daughter's school. My wife was going to go ahead and get to the other children, and I had to get to the junior high. As I got to that junior high, I was going in, and the principal stopped me, and then the dean there and the counselor was there with him, who I knew very, very, very well. He was a very good friend of mine. Two of his children were karate students of mine. And the dean stopped me, or the principal stopped me, and he said, if you're here to pick up one of your children, you can't do that. And I said, oh, yes, I can. And the vice principal, he said, you better let him in. He said, I know Mr. Gallagher very well. He can get his daughter and anybody else he wants to take. I said, good call. So anyway, if we could start that now.
help trapped in that inferno.
If you could turn the lights down, go ahead and turn the lights down.
The true spirit of a community can most often be measured during a disaster. An unexpected crisis can bring people closer together and remind them of what is truly important in life, family and friends. That's what happened in Henderson, Nevada on May 4th, 1988, when a fire in a chemical plant caused a series of violent explosions. These blasts were so powerful that you'll actually see the shockwaves as they move through the air. Our story begins when Dennis Todd, an engineer, arrives on his job 5 miles from that same chemical plant with, as luck would have it, his video camera. That camera and others would capture the terrifying moments of that day and the personal stories of a community under fire.
May 4th, 1988, I'd been contracted to do routine maintenance work on a TV transmit facility on Black Mountain in Henderson, Nevada. I carry a video camera with me to videotape certain processes that go on during my work. While working on the mountaintop, one of my employees noticed that there was this fire producing quite dense black smoke below us.
Look at that flame spread, will you?
And an engineer from one of the other television stations came over, and he mentioned that that was Pepcom, and it was a rocket fuel plant.
What did they make there, Chuck?
It's a solid propellant for rockets.
Oh, my God.
I was dumbfounded at the speed at which this material was burning and spreading and the brilliance of this flame, unlike a flame I had never seen before.
Did you call somebody?
Yeah, fire department.
We're taught to notice the color of the fires because it'll tell you a great deal about what's burning. The colors were a weird orange, brown, gray color, and that's not normal in a building fire.
I worked for Pepcom for about 7 years prior to the fire, and I was there the day it happened. I think my biggest concern at that point in time was trying to make sure that we got people out.
I could see that toxic cloud, and that really bothered me because the cloud was blowing basically right toward us. We were going to have to kind of enter the cloud to get to where we had to go. I told my driver to stop probably 1,200 feet from the plant. And I'm standing next to the ambulance. I'm putting on my air pack. The first explosion came and blew me into the ambulance.
Oh!
I turned around and saw the first explosion, and it took 8 or 9 seconds before the shockwave got to us, and it was very loud.
The business we owned, the gravel plant, was probably 1,500 to 2,000 feet from Pepcom. Sounded just like a bomb that went off right next to us.
People got out of that.
I was sure that somebody was going to be seriously injured and perhaps killed.
I know what the Japanese felt like in Hiroshima. It was that intense. I was probably a quarter of a mile from the blast site. But I remember looking over my shoulder and seeing my office just annihilated, and running in the office, looking down the hallway and seeing my wife covered with glass. That was our cue that we better get the heck out of there.
Oh, there's another one.
There were 2 or 3 more smaller explosions, which we could barely hear the boom from. After the flames had subsided and all we could see was smoke coming out, I felt, well, this must have been the end of it, that everything that was going to explode had exploded.
And as we stopped and got out of the rig again and started to put on our air packs again, the big explosion came. And I mean, this thing was huge.
That one picked me up and blew me through the air some distance, I don't know, maybe 30, 40 feet. I was never exactly sure where I started or exactly where I finished up. The blast took both of my eardrums out and ruptured them, filled my ear canals with sand and gravel. I looked up, there was the most horrible rain of stuff coming down out of the sky. Rocks, pieces of metal. I thought probably something would hit me and there was a good chance that it would kill me.
Everything disappeared. Radio traffic went dead. And I thought, my God, we've lost everybody. You could see this shockwave coming across the ground at you. I kept waiting for arms and legs and these bodies to come flying through the air at me. Well, there were things flying through the air at me, but it wasn't bodies.
I could see, even in the viewfinder of the camera, the shockwave traveling across the desert floor. I had been looking at the marshmallow plant, and as this explosion occurred, the shockwaves rippled the roof on the building. The building was being destroyed in front of my eyes.
Okay, and go ahead and raise the lights back up. As you can see, that was quite an event. One of the things that dawned on me as I was going into Henderson, Nevada that day was that I had 67 homes insured within a few miles of that explosion. Over the next 48 hours, I stood in every one of those 67 homes. And let me tell you something that I saw. From my company, from State Farm, from Farmers, from Allstate, from American Family, from Liberty Mutual, from every single company represented imaginable, I saw the insurance industry that we represent rebuild homes, rebuild people's lives, take them into homes where their homes was destroyed and they had to live someplace. It wasn't government dollars. It wasn't FEMA. It wasn't all the stuff that hits the news. It was the insurance dollars that took care of the people in that community and rebuilt that community. One of the individuals that died in that was one of the clients of one of the agents in the company that I represented. And I saw those dollars from an insurance company keep that family in their life. Another individual was disabled, and they had disability insurance, and the disability insurance kept them in their world. You know, what I wanted to do is talk about some other events with everything that we represent. Yesterday, I stood in the hospital and visited two of my agents whose children are at the Primary Children's Hospital with devastating life-threatening illnesses. One of the agents stepped away, and he and I walked down the hall, and he expressed to me his incredible gratitude to health insurance and the decision that he made to make sure that his family had that care, that they didn't have to think about where does the money come from to get the best care that could possibly be given to save that child's life. That thought never had to cross his mind. He could only concentrate with his wife and his children on the prayers and the faith and the life and the dignity that they could muster and the courage to be with their child and not have to think about any of the financial consequences and devastation that could enter their life. When I was also a fairly new agent, we've talked about property insurance and health insurance. I had a client whose son one day was driving to an early morning church class, which many in this room know of as seminary. And in Nevada, that usually starts anywhere between 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the morning. And it was probably about 5:45. And as this young man, a good young man, he's driving to seminary. He's not even a football game or anything. He's driving to seminary, inexperienced driver. The sun hits his eyes. He veers off the road where there's not a sidewalk. and he, carrying other kids with him, and he hits a telephone pole, a light pole. Devastating accident. One of the young ladies in that car ended up having back surgery and neck surgery. Insurance dollars did two things. Number one, they were there to help that young lady at some point in her life. But number two, that particular client called me up. And he said, Ken, I want to come talk to you. Now, I had automobile insurance with him, homeowners insurance, RV insurance. I had IRAs. I had investment dollars. I had life insurance. He said, I want to come talk to you about my premiums. Well, I thought, wow, okay. So I had my assistant at that time. I said, I want you to get everything together. Get all the paperwork, all the claims we've paid out, why the insurance premiums have gone up. And I'm ready to defend every reason why the rates went up. And he comes into my office, and he's sitting across from my desk, and he's a big man. Everybody's a big man to me. And he's a big man. And he's sitting across the desk, and I started to explain to him why his insurance premiums went up, and he reached across the desk, and he grabbed my hand. He says, Ken, I'm sorry. He said, did you think I was here to complain? And I said, well, that's why most people come in. And he says, no, I'm not. He said, I'm here to thank you. Had it not been for the coverages that you insisted I got, those children would not have been able to be taken care of, and I would have lost everything I had. See, it was insurance dollars. It wasn't the government, wasn't the banks. It was insurance dollars. It was what we do every single day of our lives. When I was a fairly new agent, I remember I was out visiting a young family. I sold them their life insurance. At that time, I was not selling automobile and homeowners insurance. I started out in the insurance, life insurance business only with the company I'm still with now. Did that for 6 years before I went into the multi-line division. And as I was sitting down with this young couple, I said, you know, we have a disability policy, and if something happens to you, if you become sick or you become disabled through accident, what we'd like to do is be able to have this disability policy pay your house payment. And he goes, well, I don't know. And I said, I think it'd be a good idea. His wife said, I think it'd be a good idea too. So we went ahead and we wrote that disability policy up on them. And one day I get a call. And this individual and this particular disability policy, I'm going back a lot of years, paid whether you're injured at work or not injured or anything like that, whether it was work-related or not. He was jumping from a truck onto a dock, devastating broken ankle and leg. Because he was a physical worker, he was going to be out of work for a long time, had to go through multiple surgeries. And I'll never forget his wife calling me and saying, Ken, are we going to be okay? What she was saying is, do we get to keep our house? That's what she was asking me. I said, yes, you're going to be fine. Back then, there was only a two-week elimination period. That shows how long ago this was. But I showed up every month and hand-delivered those checks for their house payment. Well, he got out of the hospital, and he's back to getting back to work and going through rehab. And all of a sudden, he goes back in the hospital. And his wife calls me. She says, his appendix burst. He's back in the hospital. While he's in the hospital, he gets hepatitis. Now he is devastatingly out of work for a long period of time. Four little children, a house payment, barely getting by from work in and of itself. And she says, Ken, are we going to be okay? And again, what she was saying is, are we going to have food on our table? Is our house going to be here for our children that we don't have to yank them out of their school and go live with parents or friends or find some charity that's going to take care of us? And I said, yes, everything's going to be fine. To this very day, that family actually sends me. Matter of fact, the last card they sent me was a birthday card, a Groundhog Day card, a Christmas Day card. You know, they sent me every card on the face of this earth. I used to go over to their home for an insurance review, and you would have thought when I walked in that house, I was the rock star that walked in that house. Another family, one time I went in, and the children were saying to their dad, Dad, what's an insurance agent? Why are you taking time to meet with them? He said, you know when you lose a tooth and the fairy used to come by and give you something that was really important to replace that tooth? And he goes, yeah. He goes, that's what an insurance agent is. When we lose something very important to us, they come in and replace it with something very valuable. in our world money. I was a brand new agent. I had started in the fall of the year, going actually full time. And I was in a home of an old missionary companion of mine, he and his wife. And it was not too long before Christmas. And my company at that time gave us an advance on commissions if I sold a policy and got it paid. And it was getting towards Christmas, and I don't know about you, but when I was a young, struggling agent, especially prior to Christmas, I used to say every night in my prayers, Lord, please just help me make it through Christmas. Somehow, let me have enough money to get my little babies something under the tree. And I was in there, and I'd gone back. It was my only really good prospect. So I went back there over and over and over again. I don't know if you've done that. So finally, the wife said to the husband, she said, I think you're just putting Ken off. We need the life insurance. Let's go ahead and get it. She goes, anyway, he needs some Christmas money. They were good friends. I said, thank you. We wrote it up. As time went on, I eventually became a multi-line agent. We took care of their auto, their home, their business insurance. Their life insurance program grew. We took care of their health insurance and their business. One day I was coming out of a meeting in my general agent's office, and his secretary said, you need to pick up the phone. Somebody wants to talk to you. You'll want to go into Floyd's office, the general agent. It's a very private, very important call. I went in, shut the door, picked it up, and this young wife told me that her husband, this client that I'd written their life insurance on years before, had tragically passed away at a very young age with three young children at home to support and a house. And she asked me, she said, Ken, are we going to be okay? What she was saying is there some life insurance in there? Are we going to have our house? Are we going to be able to keep the business? Am I going to be able to put my son on a mission? Can I send my daughters to school? Can we still have Christmas? Can we still have birthdays? Can we still do all the things that we built as a life and a family together? I said, yes, you're going to be okay. Go through the funeral, get all that. I'll get all the paperwork. I'll get everything taken care of. A few days later, right after the funeral had occurred, I get a call from her. She says, Ken, she goes, you won't believe what just happened. And I said, what happened? She goes, the savings and loan that we have our business loans through and our business automobile loans through just froze my savings and checking account. They just told me that they were calling the loan on our business vehicles and my one personal Suburban. She just started crying. What am I going to do? I said, hang up. Go over to your sister's house. I'll take care of this. I called up the savings and loan. See, I mentioned to you I came from a banking background. Well, now I'm going to tell you what I really did. I was a collector. I repossessed cars for a living. I knew what had occurred. We had an individual that sat in our installment credit department. Now they do it by all technology, but it's still done. And they would review the obituaries to see if any of their clients had passed away. Because in paragraph 18 of the contract back then, I don't know what paragraph it is now, it says if ever our collateral is in jeopardy, we can go ahead and call the loan. And that's exactly what they did within days of him passing away. And I tried to reach the president of the savings and loan, and I got through to the executive vice president. And I said, I'm Ken Gallagher. I happen to be the insurance agent to this family. I know that there's going to be enough money coming in to take care of their home, to take care of your loan, to keep them in the world. And if you do not release her funds up immediately, my next call will be to my attorney and she will own your savings and loan. And he said, Mr. Gallagher, you're right. And those funds were released immediately. See, that was not the government coming to her defense. That was not the bank certainly not helping out. The savings and loan was the enemy. It was insurance dollars that secured that family, and their life. That's what we do every single day of our lives. Whether it's at the boardroom or the kitchen table or our office, we save lives. 1987, my family and I, well, actually, Ken Jones, sitting right here, called me up one day and he said, would you teach a disability class for LUTC? I said, sure, I will. I thought, well, if I'm going to teach it, I need to own it. So I went out and bought me some disability insurance. Little did I know what was about to happen in my life. February 13th, on a Friday, by the way, I was coming back with my family from Disneyland on the Riverside Freeway. As we're driving back, I was in a 15-passenger van. The van started to lose power. I realized it was going to come to a stop. 6:30, Friday night, Riverside Freeway, packed, a lot of fast traffic. I moved over. At that time, there was an inside emergency lane. I moved over there, right underneath a great big light that said, not a travel lane, emergency lane, with big blinking lights. Then I did something to this very day. I don't know why I did it. The car went dead. I got out of the car, the van. I walked around to the front of it and lifted the hood. Now, I have no idea what's under the hood. None. In high school, I think I knew there was a carburetor or something. I walk in front, but that's what you do when you're with your wife and children, right? You go over, you open up the hood. You're stupid about everything under there, but you think you look smart anyway. I open up the hood, and I'm standing there. My wife leans out. She goes, Ken, I don't feel good. Please come back inside the car. Just then, I received a strong impression to brace myself. I started to let down the hood. I braced myself, and that was the last thing I remembered. A drunk driver hit that van from behind with me in front of it. The police report says going 75 miles an hour plus, because no brakes were ever applied and they had no skid marks to determine the actual impact. Except the van was knocked over 55 feet, a 15-passenger van, and with 75 feet of strewn glass and metal. My face broke out the windshield. My body broke out the hood and the undercarriage of the hood. It broke out the grill. My knees dented the bumper. The next thing that I knew, I was waking up on the freeway. And I remember coming to slightly. I was in and out of consciousness for the next couple of days. As I was coming to, it was raining. And I remember this rain coming down, and there was something very warm in my face. What I did not realize what it was my face was obliterated. They had to rebuild my nose and my cheekbone. I had a broken elbow, hip broken in two places, three broken ribs, a punctured lining of the stomach, bruised heart, bruised liver, punctured sac around the heart. All this from the impact. And as I was waking up, and I always like to tell people I was actually 6 foot prior to the accident. And as I was waking up, I remember thinking to myself, I've laid down and taken a nap on the freeway. I saw the retainer wall. Now, I don't know how many of you ever been hit by a van, but afterwards you're really tired. And I thought, this is the stupidest thing. Why am I sleeping on the freeway? And then I started to become aware of things around me. And I could see the van off in the distance. And I wanted to make my way to my wife and my children. And a young man held me down. On Riverside Freeway in California. And in this audience, I'm going to tell this story because I always give credit to the Lord. No matter where I tell the story, He's the one that saved my life. But this was unique because I was in a state of panic. I was trying very hard to make it to my family. They took my wife away from me after she held me in her arms, thinking that I had passed away on the freeway. As she was approaching the van, she said, "What am I going to tell my children that their daddy just died?" She said, and the Spirit came to her, said, "He's going to be okay. She got in the car and she goes, Daddy's going to be fine. The young man holding me down, he said, you've been damaged. You've been hurt very, very badly. He said, please stay still. I didn't know who he was. And he said, I belong to the exact same church you do. There was a peace. The peace that just, that there was somebody there that I knew. Well, I had a long trek ahead of me. That night, I'm laying on a table. About 2 a.m, they let my wife and children know that they thought I was going to survive. They said the next 24 to 48 hours is very critical. There was brain damage, which my wife reminds me of often. And I always use it as an excuse. Honey, remember, I'm brain damaged. They brought her and my children in. As they brought them in to visit with me, I remember thinking this could have been the last day I ever spent with my family. It rained all day long. I was frustrated. And I realized that never again in my life will I be frustrated. Oh, I have tenseness sometimes. But I enjoy the moment. When I'm sitting with a friend, when I'm sitting with a loved one, when I'm in a group like this with you, I can't even begin to tell you the love that I feel. And how happy I am just to be doing what I'm doing. Well, my wife said to me, she said, Ken, are we going to be okay? You know what she was asking me? She, it was obvious I wasn't going to work Monday. She was wondering, is the house payment going to be paid? Are our bills going to be paid? Are we going to have food on the table? Is our life going to change dramatically or drastically? And I was able to say to her, hun, remember that disability policy I bought? And she said, yes. I said, we're going to be okay. She goes, how about the office? I said, remember that business overhead package I bought? She said, yes. I said, the office is going to be fine. Not one person lost their job. Not one meal was missed in my house. Not one house payment ever went behind. Even my wife's brand new vacuum cleaner that she bought, the payment was made on that every single month. And then I said to her, I said, no, that, remember when you asked me what I was going to do when I grew up? I said, I was going to be an insurance agent. And that look you gave me? I said, this year our renewals, this is 1987. I said, our renewals for just waking up in the morning are going to be $52,000. Hon, we're okay. That was in February 13th. May of that year, April of that year, I was actually the leading agent in the region and the agency. And our regional director, Chuck Hill, called me up and says, Ken, you might want to consider not coming back to work. You're doing pretty good. Disability. Was it the charity that helped me? Was it the government that helped me? No, it was insurance dollars that we sell every single day of our life. Our most important responsibility, career-wise, is to every day realize that we are licensed to help people in their lives. We should ask every person that we see and every person that we know and every review that they have, if they have the products and the investment products that we sell. Let me end with two things. My father passed away that year following that, and he had life insurance. It wasn't a huge policy, but for their life, it was big. I'll never forget traveling with my mother and my wife and my four children. We're at Orlando, we're at Disney World. And my mom had this little life insurance policy and some investment dollars that I'd set her and my dad up with. It was just a little investment years ago that just kind of built. And my mom said to me, I want to buy you and the kids dinner at Epcot. And she wanted to buy us dinner at the Norwegian restaurant because she was Norwegian. And it was expensive. Now I'm making well into six figures. My mom's on Social Security and this little tiny life insurance pension that my dad had set up for her. And I said, oh, Mom, no. You're not going to buy us dinner. My wife, and I saw her looked kind of down. My wife pulled me aside. She said, Ken, let Mom buy dinner. That means more to her than you could ever imagine. And I went back and I said, Mom, I'm brain dead. I don't think my credit card will clear. Marcia's got it. And I said, yeah, we'd love to have you buy us dinner. The dignity that that gave to her, the pride in front of her grandchildren to buy that dinner, priceless, as the advertisement says. Well, that happens to be, I'm going to end with this, that happens to be Havasupai. A number of this group may have been down there on a scout outing of some kind. It's a pretty popular place. I know Mark's been there. I've seen him down there. Havasupai stands for the people of the blue-green water. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been on earth. It's unique. It's an oasis in the middle of a desert at the bottom of one of the fingers of the Grand Canyon. Well, I was going to go on this scout outing, and I didn't want to go. You know when you're always got too busy to go do something that's important? You know, and my wife talked to me, she goes, well, both your boys are going. You need to go. I said, oh, man, I've got so much I've got to do. I've got a meeting I've got to go to somewhere, I'm sure. It was going to be a long hike. She goes, Ken, you got to go. So I went. And I'll never forget waking up on this finger of the overlooking the Grand Canyon with cliffs off both sides. And I woke up in a sleeping bag with both my sons, one on each side of me. Priceless. Well, we were walking down to the bottom of the Grand Canyon to have a soup eye, and as I'm walking down there, I started thinking, now I know why I didn't want to come. 5 hours later, 4 hours later, I'm just dead tired. I'm sore. I'm miserable. My kids are off doing their thing. They forgot their dad was even with them, and I'm thinking, this isn't as fun as everybody told me it was going to be. And all of a sudden, I look up, and there's an elderly lady and her grandson walking towards me. And she's got just a step that is just, she's got spring in her step, and she's excited, and she's getting ready to make this incredible trek out. I get talking to her. She's 84 years old. She goes, I make this trek every year with one of my grandkids. It's my grandson. I said, wow, I'm impressed. I'm not near as tired as I was a few minutes ago. And she said to me, she said, all you got to do is keep on walking. And you're going to see the most beautiful sight you've probably seen in your life. So as we went down there, as I was starting to walk away from her, she said, oh, by the way, don't forget to get your patch. This is my patch from Havasupai. And it reminds me of one thing. And that is, all I have to do in life, all I have to do in my career to make it better, day by day, month by month, week by week, year by year, is just keep on walking. All I've got to do as a dad and a grandfather of 13 is every day, just take one more step and keep on walking in the direction that I know I need to go. Why do I know that the agency system, whether you're an independent agent, a multiple line agent, a career life agent, a long-term care agent, it doesn't matter, but the agency system is the best system on the face of this earth for distribution of our products, the most important products, is because I'm part of that system. I've watched people's homes get rebuilt. I've watched liability insurance dollars step in and protect people. I've watched our health insurance dollars for a young father say, this is one of the best decisions I've ever made, that I don't have to worry about the cost of the care of my little ones. I've watched the insurance dollars through disability keep people in their lives and their home, including my own family. I've watched life insurance dollars send children on missions, send children to college, keep people in their homes, take care of Christmas, take care of birthdays, give people dignity on into the elderly years of their life. That's why this system is the greatest system on the face of this earth. What we do every day. John F. Kennedy said this, and I'm going to end with this. And by the way, I Googled this morning to see if it was a true quote. I can think of no more effective agent in advancing our freedom to live as we choose than the insurance salesperson. This person knows the economic and human pulse of the country as few people may. For they walk all streets of life. They sit down and talk with youth, the mature, and the aged. They build, for they are helpers to build. They ensure the future. They are respected, and they are our friends. May the good Lord bless each and every one of us to live up to the incredible potential that we have and to get more people involved in things like this, that we can grow. Me lift thee and thee lift me, as John Greenleaf Whittier said, and we all ascend together. Thank you very much for letting me be here.